Chapter 5. A pretty numerous company were gathered together at this spot, for, besides the officers in attendance to enforce the proclamation, there was a motley crowd of lookers-on of various degrees, who raised from time to time such shouts and cries as the circumstances called forth. A spruce young courtier was the first who approached. He unsheathed a weapon of burnished steel, that shone and glistened in the sun, and handed it with the newest air to the officer, who, finding it exactly 3 feet long, returned it with a bow. Thereupon the gallant raised his hat and crying, "God save the Queen!" passed on amidst the plaudits of the mob. Then came another, a better courtier still, who wore a blade, but 2 feet long, whereat the people laughed, much to the disparagement of his honor's dignity. Then came a third, a sturdy old officer of the army, girded with a rapier at least a foot and a half beyond her majesty's pleasure. At him they raised a great shout, and most of the spectators, but especially those who were armorers or cutlers, laughed very heartily at the breakage which would ensue. But they were disappointed, for the old campaigner, coolly unbuckling his sword and bidding his servant carry it home again, passed through unarmed, to the great indignation of all the beholders. They relieved themselves in some degree by hooting a tall blustering fellow with a prodigious weapon, who stopped short on coming in sight of the preparations, and after a little consideration turned back again. But all this time no rapier had been broken, although it was high noon, and all cavaliers of any quality or appearance were taking their way towards St. Paul's Churchyard. During these proceedings, Master Graham had stood apart, strictly confining himself to the duty imposed upon him, and taking little heed of anything beyond. He stepped forward now as a richly dressed gentleman on foot, followed by a single attendant, was seen advancing up the hill. As this person drew near, the crowd stopped their clamor, and bent forward with eager looks. Master Graham standing alone in the gateway, and the stranger coming slowly towards him, they seemed, as it were, set face to face. The nobleman, for he looked one, had a haughty and disdainful air, which bespoke the slight estimation in which he held the citizen. The citizen, on the other hand, preserved the resolute bearing of one who was not to be frowned down or daunted, and who cared very little for any nobility but that of worth and manhood. It was perhaps some consciousness on the part of each, of these feelings in the other, that infused a more stern expression into their regards as they came closer together. "Your rapier, worthy sir!" At the instant that he pronounced these words Graham started, and falling back some paces, laid his hand upon the dagger in his belt. "You are the man whose horse I used to hold before the bowyer's door? You are that man? Speak. Out, you prentice hound." Said the other. "You are he. I know you well now." Cried Graham. "Let no man step between us two, or I shall be his murderer." With that he drew his dagger, and rushed in upon him. The stranger had drawn his weapon from the scabbard ready for the scrutiny, before a word was spoken. He made a thrust at his assailant, but the dagger which Graham clutched in his left hand, being the dirk in use at that time for parrying such blows, promptly turned the point aside. They closed. The dagger fell rattling on the ground, and Graham, wresting his adversary's sword from his grasp, plunged it through his heart. As he drew it out, it snapped in two, leaving a fragment in the dead man's body. All this passed so swiftly that the bystanders looked on without an effort to interfere, but the man was no sooner down than an uproar broke forth which rent the air. The attendant rushing through the gate proclaimed that his master, a nobleman, had been set upon and slain by a citizen. The word quickly spread from mouth to mouth. St. Paul's Cathedral, and every bookshop, ordinary, and smoking house in the churchyard poured out its stream of cavaliers and their followers, who mingling together in a dense tumultuous body, struggled, sword in hand, towards the spot. with equal impetuosity, and stimulating each other by loud cries and shouts, the citizens and common people took up the quarrel on their side, and encircling Master Graham 100 deep, forced him from the gate. In vain he waved the broken sword above his head, crying that he would die on London's threshold for their sacred homes. They bore him on, and ever keeping him in the midst, so that no man could attack him, fought their way into the city. The clash of swords and roar of voices, the dust and heat and pressure, the trampling underfoot of men, the distracted looks and shrieks of women at the windows above as they recognized their relatives or lovers in the crowd, the rapid tolling of alarm bells, the furious rage and passion of the scene, were fearful. Those who, being on the outskirts of each crowd, could use their weapons with effect, fought desperately, while those behind, maddened with baffled rage, struck at each other over the heads of those before them, and crushed their own fellows. Wherever the broken sword was seen above the people's heads, towards that spot the cavaliers made a new rush. Every one of these charges was marked by sudden gaps in the throng, where men were trodden down, but as fast as they were made, the tide swept over them, and still the multitude pressed on again, a confused mass of swords, clubs, staves, broken plumes, fragments of rich cloaks and doublets, and angry, bleeding faces, all mixed up together in inextricable disorder. The design of the people was to force Master Graham to take refuge in his dwelling, and to defend it until the authorities could interfere, or they could go in time for parley. But either from ignorance or in the confusion of the moment they stopped at his old house, which was closely shut. Some time was lost in beating the doors open and passing him to the front. About a score of the boldest of the other party threw themselves into the torrent, while this was being done, and reaching the door at the same moment with himself cut him off from his defenders. I never will turn in such a righteous cause, so help me heaven! Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Graham, in a voice that at last made itself heard, and confronting them as he spoke. Least of all will I turn upon this threshold which owes its desolation to such men as ye. I give no quarter, and I will have none. Strike! Apostrophe, for a moment they stood at bay. At that moment a shot from an unseen hand, apparently fired by some person who had gained access to one of the opposite houses, struck Graham in the brain, and he fell dead. A low wail was heard in the air, many people in the concourse cried that they had seen a spirit glide across the little casement window of the bowyer's house, a dead silence succeeded. After a short time some of the flushed, unheeded throng laid down their arms, and softly carried the body within doors. Others fell off or slunk away in knots of two or three, others whispered together in groups, and before a numerous guard which then rode up could muster in the street, it was nearly empty. Those who carried Master Graham to the bed upstairs were shocked to see a woman lying beneath the window with her hands clasped together. After trying to recover her in vain, they laid her near the citizen, who still retained, tightly grasped in his right hand, the first and last sword that was broken that day at Ludgate. The giant uttered these concluding words with sudden precipitation, and on the instant the strange light which had filled the hall faded away. Joe Todd glanced involuntarily at the eastern window, and saw the first pale gleam of morning. He turned his head again towards the other window in which the giants had been seated. It was empty. The cask of wine was gone, and he could dimly make out that the two great figures stood mute and motionless upon their pedestals. After rubbing his eyes and wondering for full half an hour, during which time he observed morning come creeping on apace, he yielded to the drowsiness which overpowered him, and fell into a refreshing slumber. When he awoke it was broad day. The building was open, and workmen were busily engaged in removing the vestiges of last night's feast. Stealing gently down the little stairs, and assuming the air of some early lounger who had dropped in from the street, he walked up to the foot of each pedestal in turn, and attentively examined the figure it supported. There could be no doubt about the features of either, He recollected the exact expression they had worn at different passages of their conversation, and recognized in every line and lineament the giants of the night. Assured that it was no vision, but that he had heard and seen with his own proper senses, he walked forth, determining at all hazards to conceal himself in the guild hall again that evening. He further resolved to sleep all day, so that he might be very wakeful and vigilant, and above all that he might take notice of the figures at the precise moment of their becoming animated, and subsiding into their old state, which he greatly reproached himself for not having done already. Correspondence to Master Humphrey, Sir, before you proceed any further in your account of your friends, and what you say and do when you meet together, excuse me if I proffer my claim to be elected to one of the vacant chairs in that old room of yours. Don't reject me without full consideration, for if you do, you will be sorry for it afterwards, you will, upon my life. I enclose my card, Sir, in this letter. I never was ashamed of my name, and I never shall be. I am considered a devilish gentlemanly fellow, and I act up to the character. If you want a reference, ask any of the men at our club. Ask any fellow who goes there to write his letters what sort of conversation mine is. Ask him if he thinks I have the sort of voice that will suit your deaf friend, and make him hear, if he can hear anything at all. Ask the servants what they think of me. There's not a rascal among them, Sir, but will tremble to hear my name. That reminds me, don't you say too much about that housekeeper of yours. It's a low subject, damned low. I tell you what, Sir. If you vote me into one of those empty chairs, you'll have among you a man with a fund of gentlemanly information that'll rather astonish you. I can let you into a few anecdotes about some fine women of title that are quite high life, Sir, the tip-top sort of thing. I know the name of every man who has been out on an affair of honor within the last 25 years. I know the private particulars of every cross and squabble that has taken place upon the turf, at the gaming table, or elsewhere, during the whole of that time. I have been called the Gentlemanly Chronicle. You may consider yourself a lucky dog. Upon my soul, you may congratulate yourself, though I say so. It's an uncommon good notion that of yours, not letting anybody know where you live. I have tried it, but there has always been an anxiety respecting me, which has found me out. Your deaf friend is a cunning fellow, to keep his name so close. I have tried that too, but have always failed. I shall be proud to make his acquaintance tell him so, with my compliments. You must have been a queer fellow when you were a child, confounded queer. It's odd, all that about the picture in your first paper prosy, but told in a devilish gentlemanly sort of way. In places like that I could come in with great effect with a touch of life, don't you feel that? I am anxiously waiting for your next paper to know whether your friends live upon the premises, and at your expense, which I take it for granted is the case. If I am right in this impression, I know a charming fellow, an excellent companion, and most delightful company, who will be proud to join you. Some years ago he seconded a great many prize fighters, and once fought an amateur match himself. Since then he has driven several males, broken at different periods all the lamps on the right-hand side of Oxford Street, and 6 times carried away every bell handle in Bloomsbury Square, besides turning off the gas in various thoroughfares. In point of gentlemanliness he is unrivaled, and I should say that next to myself he is of all men the best suited to your purpose. Expecting your reply, I am. And C. Master Humphrey informs this gentleman that his application, both as it concerns himself and his friend, is rejected. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.